Frederick Law Olmsted left his mark on our country, left it on Louisville's parks, New York's Central Park, the Capitol grounds in Washington, Yosemite in California, Niagara Falls, Prospect Park in Brooklyn, the Biltmore Estate, the University of Chicago, Stanford University. We're just barely even highlighting the projects he undertook and completed as a landscape architect. And it's amazing to think that centuries from now, we'll still see his impact, most likely, on the landscape, the work and the vision of this man. Well, the biographer Justin Martin is with me. He's explored deeply the life and the work and the thought of Olmsted, and he's written a book called Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted. He's in Louisville for an event this evening with the Olmsted Parks Conservancy. That's sold out, I am sorry to say. Or good for you, Justin, I guess.
That's great. I'm pleased.
So you may not be able to make it tonight, but you can certainly be here and listen to this conversation. And we hope to maybe pique your interest in the life of Olmsted over the next 15 minutes or so. Given the time frame, I thought, well, let's maybe pick some areas that I was less familiar with. And so this is a little bit capricious on my part, although I definitely want to talk about Louisville, and a lot of us are interested in that. But I did not realize that, I guess, first of all, that Frederick Law Olmsted had a career that encompassed so much more than this amazing career as a landscape architect, that he was also a reporter and a very capable one at that. And there was tied into this story of his reporting in the very early days of the New York Daily Times, the story of his evolving views over slavery. And so I'd like, if we could, to start a little bit there and maybe, first of all, talk about that ability that he had as a journalist.
He turned out to be a very capable journalist. He was selected for this brand new kind of a startup newspaper called the New York Times based on a 5-minute interview. And he kind of established two things in those 5 minutes. First of all, believe it or not, he was a farmer. And the New York Times liked the idea that they would be sending a farmer to the South, because the South in that era was an agrarian society. And secondly, he was able to establish that he did not have an agenda. He was neither on the side of slaveholding, nor was he an abolitionist. And so they thought, perfect person to send to the South. It was a startup, so they didn't know what they were going to get exactly. What they turned out to get was just spectacular. He turned out to be just a really great natural reporter. He talked to all kinds of different people. He talked to plantation owners. He talked to slaves. He produced this great series of dispatches. And I think what really distinguishes his series of dispatches is that because he came at it so open-mindedly and he was gradually convinced of what was wrong with slavery, he presented an anti-slavery, an abolition case that was much more humane and moving than had he just come in with a pre-existing agenda. And so it made for very powerful reporting, because he traveled through the South, he saw and observed certain things, and he was able to recount them in a way that really communicated what ultimately, in his estimation, was wrong with the institution of slavery.
And I want to have you give some detail of the nuance of that reporting and what he saw, but I want to step back for a moment, because maybe it's hard in today's context for us to imagine that someone might be really neither here nor there on the issue of slavery. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how his views had evolved up to that point.
Sure. And he was not a naïf or anything like that. What it was he was what was called a gradualist. And it was a pretty common stance. And the idea for gradualists, and really someone like Thomas Jefferson was a gradualist. They had a couple of, first of all, there was a feeling, and Olmsted certainly had this notion that the United States, as a republic, there was no one state or region had a right to impose its views on another region. So slavery was an institution in many southern states. Olmsted, as a native of New York, did not feel that the North had any right to impose its viewpoint on the South. He also felt that he recognized, particularly as a farmer, he recognized that slavery was an old institution. You couldn't just wave a wand and say, make this disappear. It was a complex economic institution passed down over generations. And so he felt that was where gradualism came in. Thomas Jefferson would have told you slavery is evil. Olmsted would have told you slavery is evil. And yet there was a sense that this needed to be unwound carefully and thoughtfully over time, and without the intervention of some other region of the country saying, oh, you must cease and desist at once.
So I'm going to give two views of slavery and just to offer as contrast to what maybe he discovered while he was there. And view number one is that the relationship between slaves and owners was at best uncaring, and at worst really an awful relationship, a very difficult relationship, and it was in a relationship of abuse. There are certainly many instances of that mm-hmm. that we know of for a fact. And that also that slavery was the lifeblood of the South, and it was the economic engine that in fact kept the South going. Now, as he goes down there with this open mind and this ability to strike up a conversation with anybody he ran into, and through anonymity, actually report what they said. What did he discover?
Well, he discovered on the count of, as you describe, how I guess he certainly saw that slavery varied. There were people who were very had very good relationships. I mean, it's from in modern terms, it's kind of queasy making to contemplate this. But there were instances in which slaves and slaveholders had an almost familial relationship. He observed this, he reported it, and it just, it's something people have to, you know, make sense of. He also, of course, observed terrible cruelty towards slaves. But
a slave girl who escaped and they caught her, and she was repeatedly lashed right in front of him.
That's right. That was an event that really kind of solidified his, because one thing that while he was traveling through the South, he certainly witnessed cruelty, cruel attitudes towards slaves. But one thing that the Southerners, his various hosts, the people he met with, they kind of jealously guarded from him was the actual punishment of slaves. But an overseer became very comfortable with Olmsted and actually whipped the slave in front of him. And it was a shocking experience for him in many ways, including his complicity. He did not step in and stop the overseer. And in fact, he was in a gully. He was on horseback when this happened. And his horse flared its nostrils and rode up out of the gully. And Olmsted, who was very attuned to the natural world, perceived that the horse's reaction, the horse's horror, was a sign that this was something that was unnatural, that was wrong. So he certainly came to that conclusion. He also came to a very powerful, he developed a very powerful, very discerning criticism of slavery based on economic grounds. As he traveled around, he observed that plantations and other slave-based agricultural endeavors tended to be extraordinarily inefficient. And so that became also something that he offered as a kind of a unique criticism.
I think, if I remember right, you said in the book that it was on any given day, he felt that on most plantations, at best, one-third of the slaves were actually working.
That's absolutely right. Correct. It was incredible. One of the things he observed, and he was a farmer, and he observed that that you had old slaves who maybe could do a little bit of work, but perhaps not very much, but they still had to be cared for and taken care of, clothed and housed. Slaves under the age of 12, maybe you could get them to scare away blackbirds or something, but there wasn't a whole lot of useful farm work they could do. Injured slaves, a woman who's menstruating, a slave who claimed to be badly injured, a female slave who claimed to be menstruating. Any of these things could diminish the amount of productivity that someone could achieve.
What was the impact of his reporting in the North? I mean, this was New York Times was a different kind of paper. It wasn't the yellow journal. It was trying to aspire to something greater than the kind of journalism that existed at other papers at the time.
It was very his reporting. The best way to describe it is sort of the right people read Olmsted. I mean, it didn't, it didn't just ripple out through the society, but a lot of, academics, politicians, sort of, you might call them in modern parlance, the opinion elite, read Olmsted's reporting and were very, found it very convincing.
As he was involved later in the Civil War, it was a medical position, wasn't it, that he had served?
Uh-huh.
How did his changing views on abolition, the fact that he became, I think, a pretty staunch abolitionist, how did that impact how he viewed what Lincoln was doing around the Emancipation Proclamation and the advancement of the Civil War toward its conclusion?
What's very interesting is a much more intimate era in which Olmsted, as the head of a battlefield relief outfit, got repeated opportunities to actually meet in the Oval Office with President Lincoln. It was just a different time when the president was more available, even to someone who wasn't, one of his top generals or what have you. And Olmsted had the opportunity repeatedly to argue for Lincoln to move faster. It's funny, Olmsted had been a gradualist, but in typical fashion, once he became an abolitionist, no one else could move quickly enough to get in line with his views. I mean, it's a classic human behavior. And so Lincoln, of course, very complicated. Lincoln also was, I guess you'd probably say, was a gradualist, and he wasn't. And so it took him time before he announced the Emancipation Proclamation, but Olmsted was all along the way, was sort of in a hurry-up mode.
We're talking with Justin Martin, who is the author of Genius at Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted. And I wanted to spend some time in our remaining time here talking about Louisville, because his impact on the city of Louisville. I've lived here about 3.5 years, and it didn't take me long to see the enormity of what he did here. And it's one of the few places in the country, I think only 4 in total, where he actually completed a full system of parks and parkways. And I wonder if we could spend a little time talking about that, maybe with first getting an idea of the, because his firm involved others and certainly his sons and the rest, the extent of Frederick Law Olmsted's involvement in Louisville directly.
Sure. Frederick Law Olmsted's direct involvement is really the 3 big parks that are the Shawnee, Cherokee, and Iroquois. Those were the parks that he conceived of as a park system, an idea that he actually originated. As you described, there are just a handful of other ones around the country, such as Milwaukee, Rochester, New York, the famous Emerald Necklace Park System. And so for Louisville, Olmsted developed a park system, which meant several different parcels of land outside what was then the developed part of the city. And Olmsted had this great idea that as the city expanded, if you had these several parcels of land set aside, maybe with different attributes, of course, Iroquois Park is kind of hilly, and Shawnee Park is on the bluffs overlooking the Ohio River. As the city grew up, it would surround them. The parks would serve all different diverse neighborhoods. And Olmsted also had a notion that he also originated, which was having parkways connect parkways such as Algonquin, Southern, Eastern Parkway connect the various parks. So it was a very vivid vision that he had, and really those first 3 parks, sort of the core of the Louisville park system, were envisioned by Olmsted. And then his sons came in after him during the early 20th century and added, I believe, 18 other parks, parks such as Chickasaw Park, I believe, and some smaller parks and squares as well.
You said that he had, I'm trying to think of the exact words you used, but it sounds to me like you said he had a little bit more leeway in deciding what he wanted to do with these parks, maybe than other commissions. Did I get that wrong from what you said?
I don't know if it was necessarily that he had leeway. He liked the idea of having several different parcels. That's sort of the park system concept was rather than being tied to Central Park, for instance, his very first park project. It was a single piece of what at least started out as an unattractive piece of land that he was tied to. So he always liked the idea of these park systems was a way to have several different parcels of land. They might have different attributes, like one might be hilly, one might have a nice natural lake or whatever it might be.
You've been to these parks?
I've been to the 3 main Olmsted parks in Louisville, and I've been to all kinds of other Olmsted parks.
I should ask you. I mean, they're all over the place. You certainly can't go to all of them, but you've been to many.
I've been to most of Olmsted's parks. The Olmsted firm, which came in after him in the 20th century, they sort of professionalized the practices of landscape architecture. And I have this picture in my mind that sometimes the Olmsted firm would simply kind of consult, but since they were so high profile, their name would ultimately be attached to the project. They'd say, this is an Olmsted park. But Olmsted Sr., he was more directly involved in a smaller number, although still a vast number of park and landscape projects. And I visited the majority of them, I'd say.
Just a few seconds left. But for us today, what, as we go into those parks, are maybe 2 or 3 things that we would see in our experience that would directly point back to the vision of Frederick Law Olmsted?
I guess a couple things you'd see are they're meant to be democratic spaces. That was very important to him. That's why he loved the idea of the park system, such as Louisville has, is it means that you have more than one park. You have several parks attending that are serving different neighborhoods that allows you to have this kind of glorious democratic experiment. So certainly democracy at work in the parks, Olmsteadian vision. Also, naturalistic parks that are very, very heavily landscaped. Ultimately, his goal is to make things look natural, but he was not averse to using gunpowder and all kinds of engineering techniques to make something look natural. A wonderful example is if you go to Cherokee Park, these nice rolling hills. Those rolling hills are in many ways manufactured design. It looks like nature. It's maybe even more natural than nature. That's an Olmsted trademark.
Justin Martin, thank you for coming and talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
The book is called Genius of Place. It's the life of Frederick Law Olmsted, and Justin Martin is going to appear tonight at an event that the Olmsted Parks Conservancy is putting on at 610 Magnolia. We are told that all the tickets are sold out for that, so this might be a decision that involves having a look at the book yourself. We certainly encourage you to do that.